Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. I want to get right into the Virginia ratification debates because, like I said, these are the meaty bits and nuggets of gold that support the full argument that the federal government is constrained behind these enumerated powers in the Constitution. It's very clear that what they did in this Constitution was actually give us this, and some people call it a parchment, but I'm here to tell you it's a contract. I don't even think the framers understood the magnitude of that parchment, because it may be only a piece of paper, but because it is a contract that was written for and by the states, and it's because the states defined the terms of that contract and going, you got to understand, contract law was very immature back in those days. They didn't understand the magnitude of, you know, the importance of following the contract, everything that was being said. They understood those things, but they never made the tie and the association to the fact that they have all the evidence necessary. You know, I think that there was a lot of mutual respect when people would argue one thing and they just had this mutual respect. And over time, those things started taking hold, creating unconstitutional footings and so forth. And nobody understood that course back, that pathway that takes us right back to restoring the terms of the contract. It wasn't a coincidence. It was not a coincidence that this Constitution was done so as a compact amongst the states instead of some charter, instead of some granting of general powers. It was not a coincidence that these men actually documented everything they said and how they defined the Constitution, what it meant, as well as they went through the different debates, even during the Constitutional Convention, to give us some insights. The fact that they actually argued these things in the public forum with the Federalist Papers gives us other insights. And all of these insights support the debates and the terms and conditions and the definitions that were defined during those ratification debates. And so there's probably nothing, if you really want to understand, you know, is the divine hand of providence truly involved? I am here to tell you that you can't look at how everything was laid out and what was created. That even though I completely understand at this, you know, back in their day, that they, you know, held each other with noble respect, mutual respect, and so forth, and so they didn't constantly go to the ratification debates. Bottom line, they allowed these terms and definitions to be obscured. Madison in 1821 pointed back to the ratification debates and said, "It doesn't matter what I think this Constitution means. What matters is how the states understood it as the time it was being ratified, as the time they were accepting it." And so there was some clarity on Madison's part, but there was so many other things that were going on. Madison was retired from the presidency and from public service. If you look at what John Marshall and the rest of these nefarious men were doing, you can understand how easily things started drifting and how easily people started saying, "Hey, we can do this and we can do this." And they started aggrandizing their powers and they started growing their reach into our everyday lives to a point where they're so far outside of that. It is not a coincidence that we have this compact, that we have these documentation, or the magnitude of details in this documentation that we possess. I'm here to tell you that we have the greatest opportunity, and our greatest treasure is the ratification debates. And as I tell people all the time, when you read the Ten Commandments, how do you understand what the heck those Ten Commandments mean? Unless you read the scriptures that support and explain what those Ten Commandments mean. Those Ten Commandments took on a completely new meaning in the scriptures later on when Christ started defining those. And it's the same thing with the Constitution. How do we understand what the Constitution is and what it means and what, you know, what the terms of that contract really were without reading how it was debated and how it was defined by these, by what we refer to as our framers. I never refer to them as founders. Every once in a while I'll slip because it's just a paradigm that's hard to shake. But truly the founders of this nation were the states. The framers were the men. And if you want to be accurate in context, you need to start referring to founders as the states instead of founders being the men who founded this nation. No, it was the states who founded, because it was the states who had to buy in. It wasn't just a few men. It was all of the people of each state that the majority of them bought into this. So it's a much greater magnitude when you understand what a founder is, especially in a contract. They are the parties to the compact. They are our representatives in dealing with the federal government or in dealing with this general government. But anyway, one of the things I want to, you know, make sure that you remember is that the show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And you are listening to the only show that goes through the academic evidence. The message is very clear. The things that we need to understand is that the Constitution is a compact, it's the state's compact, and the states have all the authority necessary to force compliance. They can't just willy-nilly change these things. There are all sorts of guards and mechanisms of protection that the good Lord had put into this compact for us. We're protected from standing armies because they galvanize that only within the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15, only the militia has the power to execute those laws, that Congress can call upon them to do that. But Congress cannot appoint their own enforcement. It is incumbent upon them to utilize the militia and the militia alone until they decide to change and amend the Constitution. I'm going to tell you, when people start realizing the Constitution, how it is defined, and where we are today with it, I'm telling you, the federal government is going to be really upset with the fact that they have to dismantle this leviathan of a standing army that they have put to reign tyranny upon us. When people start talking about the ATF, the BLM, and all of these other supposedly enforcement agencies, IRS, they're not constitutional. The only way we understand that is by reading the Constitution and reading how they defined it and go, well, right there. The only way they can enforce and execute the laws of the nation or the federal laws, which are constitutional and pursuant to the Constitution, the only way they can do that is by calling forth the militia to enforce those laws. And the militia is not going to enforce laws that they consider tyrannical and outside the boundaries of the Constitution. We have all sorts of mechanisms of protection. We've just ignored how the Constitution was defined because there were a lot of people that came along and started interpreting. Actually, I have evidence. It was Andrew Jackson who really was the one that started getting people to start believing in interpretations, not just the interpretation of judges, but interpretations of lawmakers and all sorts of people. And that was inaccurate and incorrect. The only way we can understand what this Constitution is, what it means, what it stands, and those terms, again, are the ratification debates. So we're going to get into the Virginia ratification debates when we're coming up on a hard break. So when we come back, we'll dive into that. A couple questions I have for you. Are you the problem? Are you still the problem? Because you no longer are the problem when you are engaged in the solution. But until you get engaged in the solution, then you're still a part of the problem. And we want to make you a part of the solution, the only solution for fixing all of our problems. It is not going against vaccinations. It's not going against abortion. It's not going and fighting Common Core. It is demanding compliance and demanding that your state legislators stand up as your representatives in protecting you from federal tyranny and getting them to assert their constitutional authority over the federal government, saying you do not have these powers. That's where we become a part of the solution. And that solution and the process is called Republic Review. And we would love to have you get on board. There's lots of ways you can get on board, but the most important way you can get on board is getting active and involved both at the politics and in the local level. And if necessary, getting yourself into service, becoming a public servant, and becoming a champion for the Constitution. Now, these Virginia ratification debates are going to take a few days because there is a lot of meat here. We're probably talking, about 20 pages maybe even more. But the bottom line is we're asking you to start inviting other people to listen and check out this show. We would be honored and humbly honored if you could help us grow this message. And that's the best way to do it, is getting other people to download the shows once we get it posted, and also tuning in, streaming, or using our dial-in, 605-562-4209. I'll repeat it when we come back from the break. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Taking the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and Republic Review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in, and let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, as we get into the very first comment, this is from Mr. George Nicholas, and this is actually on, what is this, Wednesday, the 4th of June. So in other words, they had just literally started their debates, and they had just, you know, identified committees and the president and or the the chairman of the debates and so forth. And anyway, so Mr. George Nicholas says this. It is objected, he's talking about the Constitution, however, as a defect in the Constitution that it does not prohibit the House of Representatives from giving their powers, particularly that respecting the support and etc. of armies out of their hands for no longer than 2 years. Here I think the enemies of the plans reason unfairly. They first suppose that Congress, from a love of power natural to all, will in general abuse that with which they are invested, and then they would make us apprehend that the House of Representatives, notwithstanding their love of power, and it must be supposed as great in a branch of Congress as in the whole, will give out of their hands the only check which can ensure them the continuance of the participation of powers lodged in Congress in general. In England, there is no restraint of this kind on Parliament, and yet there is no instance, of a money bill being passed for longer than 1 year. The proposed plan, therefore, when it declares that no appropriation for the support of an army shall be made for a longer term than 2 years, introduces a check unknown to the English Constitution, and one which will be found very powerful when we reflect that if the House of Representatives could be prevailed on to make an appropriation for an army for 2 years, at the end of that time, there will be a new choice of representatives. Thus, I insist that the security does not depend on the number of representatives. The experience of that country also shows that many of their counties and cities contain a great number of souls than will be entitled to a representation in America. And yet, the representatives chosen in those places have been the most strenuous advocates of liberty. Sorry about that. And in exerted themselves in the defense of it, even in opposition to those chosen by much smaller numbers. As a matter of fact, you know, there are people who seek power by demagoguery. In other words, calling, you know, like, we've got to go to war against China. And the real point in American politics has never been by saber rattling, demagoguery. I mean, Trump has used some demagoguery regarding the illegal immigration, our trade war with China, and so forth. But I think Woodrow Wilson was one that was an advocate for, but that was after he ran, an advocate for a world war. I mean, he became the champion for World War I in going after Germany, and but it was all about peace beforehand, and then as soon as, and Obama did the same thing. I mean, 9 times out of 10, when you're looking at people that are running for office, at least in American politics, it's never been based upon, you know, our need to go to war. Anyway, it's always interesting reading these types of comments, because he's clearly pointing out that, you know, with the way the appropriation goes for 2 years, it also goes that we have an opportunity to replace those who made the appropriation for an army. But anyway, he goes on and says, many of the senatorial districts in Virginia also contain a greater number of souls, and yet I suppose no gentleman within these walls will pay the senators chosen by them so poor a compliment as to attribute less wisdom and virtue to them than the delegates chosen from single counties. And so I want to point out here, too, the Constitution had not even been ratified yet. And so the states were still functioning and operating politically and as a government outside of the context of the Constitution, but they were already talking about the importance of counties and a single county of selecting delegates and so forth. Moving on, he says, and as there is greater possibility that the electors in a large district will be more independent, or a large county, so I think the representatives chosen in such districts will be more so too for those who have sold themselves to their representatives will have no right to complain if they, in turn, barter away their rights and liberties. But those who have not themselves been bought will never consent to be sold. Another objection made to the small number of representatives is that admitting they were sufficient to secure their integrity, yet they cannot be acquainted with the local situation and circumstances of their constituents. Now, you got to remember that they were complaining that 30,000 was too many. 30,000 to represent you in Congress was too many people. They wanted it even a smaller number. And today, our representation is almost at a million. It's 750,000 people. How are we being represented? Another plug for Our First Right. OurFirstRight.org. Let's get that that amendment and get our representation back to 50,000 people. It will definitely displace the swamp. And we're looking at having some conversations regarding this with Keith Broders and other people in the upcoming months. So anyway, this is the important note, though. This right here, this next two sentences. When we attend to the object of their jurisdiction, we find this objection insupportable. Congress will superintend the great national interest of the union. Local concerns are left to the state legislatures. Is that clear enough? We're talking about jurisdiction. When we attend to the object of their jurisdiction, we find this objection insupportable. Congress will superintend the great national interest regarding trade, you know, exporting, importing, the national interest, not what is going on in the states. And he says, Congress will superintend the great national interest of the union. Local concerns are left to the state legislators. And so he closes with this. When the members compare and communicate to one another their knowledge of their respective districts and states, their collective intelligence will sufficiently enable them to perform the objects of their cognizance of their responsibility. They cannot extend their influence or agency to any objects but those of a general nature. The representatives will therefore be sufficiently acquainted with the interests of their states, although chosen by large districts, as long as the people remain virtuous and uncorrupted. So long, we may fairly conclude, will their representatives, even be their present number, guard their interest and discharge their duty with fidelity and zeal when they become otherwise no government can possibly secure their freedom. Because bottom line, and I'm just going to take it into the context of how we look at, or how GR looks at the Constitution today, it's all about compliance. You know, can we trust anybody that does not want to comply to the standards, the terms, and definitions of this contract? When you hear people talk about, well, we want to expand your rights and, you know, we want to expand your access to benefits by giving you free college, something that's clearly not within their jurisdiction to even do, that person is absolutely calling on rebellion and supporting rebellion against the Constitution. If you are supporting something that has nothing, no enumerated powers, no granted powers for you to even meddle with, and you are out there saying we got to do these things for the people like Obamacare, Obama should have been impeached for pushing healthcare down this path. The fact of the matter is, just because they created a health department, or HEW, under Eisenhower, Health, Education, and Welfare, even though that was all unconstitutional, every time they expand upon these unconstitutional powers is still unconstitutional government and unconstitutional assertions and exertions. What we have to do is we have to get the federal government into compliance. Period. And even if we are corrupt, it does not give them the latitude to violate that Constitution. And so we have to have watchers. And maybe those watchers are, you know, in some of these red states, you know, state legislatures and so forth. And maybe in some of these other states, it might be grand juries. I don't know. But I do know this, that the next comment that we have, and these are there's a lot of comments that we've got, especially from James Madison. So this is June 6th in the Virginia debates. We're just a couple of days in. And one of the things I remember reading about Madison's role during the debates is he was sick for about half of the days. I mean, he was not even present because he had this debilitating, like diverticulitis or IBS or what have you, that was just knocking him out. I mean, it was almost like he had a tumultuous stomach flu every couple of days or so. I think he missed a whole week at one point. But anyway, when we come back, we will have Madison's comments, his first real comments regarding limitations, when we come back from these two promos. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so the first comment Madison makes, and this again is June 6th, he talks about encroachments. And he says this: since the general civilization of mankind, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. But on a candid examination of history, we shall find that turbulence, violence, and abuse of power by the majority trampling on the rights of the minority have produced factions and commotions which in republics have more frequently than others caused than any other cause produced despotism. If we go over the whole history of ancient and modern republics, we shall find their destruction to have generally resulted from those causes, which, what are the causes again? By the majority trampling on the rights of the minority. And so this is what we see currently in each of the states. You'll find that population centers are stepping on the rights of the minority within the states. They're saying, well, we don't care if you like or don't like homosexual marriage. we're going to pass this. Now, there's only two states that actually, by vote, had passed this. It has been passed or been forced, let's just use that term. It has been forced by the court system that you will, whether you like it or not, you will comply to this law that we're protecting. In other words, in some ways, the court system was protecting the minority. Well, when it comes down to your Christian values and your personal religious expressions, freedom of speech, your individual rights of bearing arms and so forth, you cannot allow. And as a matter of fact, if you look at what's going on with some states that have such an overpowering majority on the progressive side and how tyrannical they are becoming, you would think that the courts would quickly step up and say, we want to protect the minority from the majority. But they don't. It seems like they only protect the minority when it is on a liberal and or the progressive or leftist side. They never protect the minority of those on the right. And that's pretty sad. That's that reaches right into the level of oppression, abuse, or what have you. I mean, it kind of lays the groundwork for despotism. Anyway, so Madison's next comment, a couple paragraphs down, he starts talking about exclusive legislation. And what does he say? The exclusive legislation over the district. He says this. He next objects to the exclusive legislation over the district where the seat of government may be fixed. And he's talking about Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, where the federal government sits. Would he submit that the representatives of the state should carry on their deliberations under the control of any other member of the union? If any state had the power of legislation over the place where Congress should fix the general government, this would impair the dignity and hazard the safety of Congress. If the safety of the union, because you got to understand, if all of a sudden the federal government, the seat of the government was in a state and the state actually controlled the powers and there was hostility between the state and the federal government, they could start passing laws of harassing those working in the federal government and so forth. And so as he goes on, he says, if the safety of the union were under the control of any particular state, would not foreign corruption probably prevail in such a state to induce it to exert its controlling influence over the members of the general government? Gentlemen cannot have forgotten the disgraceful insult which Congress received some years ago when we also reflect that the previous session of particular states is necessary before Congress can legislate exclusively anywhere. We must instead be of being alarmed at this part, heartily approve of it. But the honorable member sees great danger in the provision concerning the militia. So now there's the next little problem. So he's kind of talked about the exclusive legislation, and now he says, now there's this danger in the provision concerning the militia. This I conceive to be additional security to our liberty without diminishing the power of the states in any considerable degree. It appears to me so highly expedient that I should imagine it would have found advocates even in the warmest friends of the present system. The authority of training the militia and appointing the officers is reserved to the states. Congress, now this is what's supposed to be happening. The states are supposed to be training the militia. Congress ought to have the power to establish a uniform discipline throughout the states and provide for the execution, and right here, this is the key, because this is what it says in the Constitution, and to provide for the execution of the laws, suppress insurrection, and repel invasions. These are the only cases wherein they can interfere with the militia, and the obvious necessity of their having power over them in these cases must convince any reflecting mind. Without uniformity of discipline, military bodies would be incapable of action. And so, guess what happened? after the War of 1812, after we've, you know, kind of recognized we were going to have a peaceful period of time, they stopped. They stopped disciplining, training, and working the militia so that the militia just became a marginalized thing. Oh, well, you know, we don't need it anymore because we just don't have any more threats. We beat the greatest power on earth. And so going on, he says this, without a general controlling power to call forth the strength of the Union to repel invasions, and there you go right there, we're talking about illegal immigration, repel invasions, the country might be overrun and conquered by foreign enemies. Without such a power to suppress insurrections, our liberties might be destroyed by domestic faction and domestic tyranny be established. Do you understand that they were recognizing community organizers and how they would use their influence over a bunch of hooligans to go out and actually threaten? We actually had an administration that supported hooligan protesting, civil unrest, and property damage, and even risking human life. Unconscionable and unconstitutional as well. The militia should have been called in to suppress all of those insurrections, because that's what these protests are. They're insurrections. You don't have a constitutional right to protest, to march through the night. You have a constitutional right to address your grievances with government. You need to get your butt down to City Hall, over to your state capital. You need to go to the seat of government, your county, wherever, and identify your grievances and have them address them. That is your constitutional right. You don't have a constitutional right to march down the city streets or what have you. Anyway, this is an interesting paragraph too, because he talks about the various means whereby nations lose their liberties. He says, the honorable member then told us there is no instance of power once transferred being voluntarily renounced. Not to produce European examples, which may probably be done before the rising of this convention, have we not seen already in 7 states, and probably in an 8th state, legislatures surrendering some of the most important powers they've possessed? And what he's talking about are the states that have previously ratified the Constitution in surrendering some of their powers and giving it to the federal government. But, sir, by this government, powers are not given to any particular set of men. They are in the hands of the people, delegated to be their representatives, chosen for short terms, to representatives responsible to the people and whose situation is perfectly similar to their own. As now, not anymore, because these people are elitist, opulent people. That's why our first right would force that to actually be, you know, brought back to your local communities and so forth. As long as this is the case, we have no danger to apprehend. When the gentleman called our recollection to the usual effects of the cession of powers and imputed the loss of liberty generally to open tyranny, I wish he had gone farther. Upon his review of history, he would have found that the loss of liberty very often resulted from factions and divisions from local considerations. That's what we're seeing today. Even as I point out, the Libertarian Party broke away from the Republican Party in 71. In 91, the Constitution Party broke away. We've been losing and we've been fractionalizing and dividing ourselves, and it is division. And when I go and call these gun owner associations of states, and when I call these individual myopic organizations that are stopped, you know, we got to stop this unconstitutional, terrible tyranny, like, you know, vaccinations or, you know, health freedom and or abortion, whatever these myopic factions are, whatever their focus is, they are dividing us over that issue. And so we'll finish this paragraph when we come back after these two promos. But we've definitely got a lot more with jurisdiction and enumerated jurisdiction and so forth when we come back from the break. And all from Madison. So we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so to wrap up, we're going to be probably just finishing Madison's comments on the 6th of January. These are probably my most cited citations. These are the most used references in documentation and or so forth, when we really start talking about all of the different things that need to be said regarding jurisdiction and so forth. They come from Madison in this, the sixth, as he lays the foundation of this defined and limited government. And so he goes on and it starts off, and actually as he was just finishing up how he spelled out the violations and encroachments of powers throughout the world and so forth, he starts on basically religion. He says, "I confess to you, sir, were uniformity of religion to be introduced by the system, it would be my opinion be ineligible. But I have no reason to conclude that uniformity of government will produce that of religion. This subject is for the honor of America. Perfectly free and unshackled, the government has no jurisdiction over it," because there is no power. This, the Bill of Rights isn't even on the table at this point. There is nothing enumerated within that Constitution that regards religion. The federal government has no jurisdiction over it. And that's what he says. The government has no jurisdiction over it. The least reflection will convince us there is no danger to be feared on this ground, because they don't have any powers delegated to them. So this goes in line with the whole thought of why we needed a Bill of Rights when we really didn't. Maybe the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, but the federal government had no jurisdiction to do anything. Possibly maybe the Fifth, maybe the Sixth and Seventh, maybe the Eighth. But when we started introducing other rights and other protections, and I know those people out there, oh, the Second Amendment, what are you kidding? You have to understand that the militia, had we maintained the compliance to the Constitution, the militia would still be the integral part of our Constitution. Had they not deliberately marginalized, we would not have probably had American meddling in foreign wars and doing regime changes and those types of things had we maintained and stuck to a militia instead of building a separate army and ignoring the Constitution and the militia. Anyway, he goes on and says this, "But we are flattered with the probability of obtaining previous amendments. This calls for the most serious attention of this House. If amendments are to be proposed by one state, the other states have the same right and will also propose alterations. These cannot be dissimilar and opposite in their nature. I beg leave to remark that the governments of the different states are in many respects dissimilar in their structure. Their legislative bodies are not similar." Okay, so he's already saying that every single state has dissimilarities, that their legislative bodies are not similar. Look today, my friends. Why is it that the legislative bodies are similar? Because after this Constitution was ratified, states started to change and align to American republicanism, recognizing the counties are sub-elements of government, and they created a Senate to represent the counties, and that the counties had at least a minimum of one representative, just like the way we had the states represented in Congress. The state, the legislatures had equal, similar representations. This all happened because of this document. As Madison was saying, these governments are dissimilar. They weren't going to be forced into changing, but they did. And they adopted these concepts of American republicanism, of representing sovereigns, that the people being sovereign were represented within the House of Representatives, and that the counties being sovereign was represented within the Senate. And so, as he says, their legislative bodies are not similar. Their executives are more different. In several of the states, the first magistrate is elected by the people at large, in others by joint ballot of the members of those of both branches of the legislature, and in others, in other different manners. This dissimilarity has occasioned a diversity of opinion on the theory of government, which will, without any reciprocal concession, render a concurrence impossible, although the appointment of an executive magistrate has not been thought destructive to the principles of democracy in many of the states, yet in the course of the debate we find objections made to the federal executive. It is urged that the president will degenerate into a tyrant. I intend, in compliance with the call of the honorable gentleman, to explain the reasons of proposing this Constitution and develop its principles, but I shall postpone my remarks till we hear the supplement which he has informed us he intends to add what he has already said. And then this is where Madison kind of goes down this hybrid concept and with enumerated powers and so forth. He says, "Give me leave to say the nature of government and to show that it is safe and just vest it in the people with the power of taxation. There are a number of opinions. The principal question is whether it be federal or a consolidated government. In order to judge properly of the question before us, we must consider it minutely in its principal parts. I conceive myself that it is of a mixed nature. It's a hybrid. It is in a manner unprecedented. We cannot find one express example in the experience of the world. It stands by itself. In some respects, it is a government of a federal nature, and in others, it's a consolidated nature. Even if we attend to the manner in which the Constitution is investigated, ratified, and made the act of the people of America, I can say, notwithstanding what the honorable gentleman has alleged, that this government is not completely consolidated, nor is it entirely federal. Who are the parties to it? the people, but not the people of composing one great body, but the people as composing 13 sovereignties. So he's pointing out that each state has its own sovereigns. And it goes without saying that within the states, you have other sovereigns called counties. So he's pointing out that there is this thing called the sovereigns, which are the state legislatures. Were it, as the gentleman asserts, a consolidated government, the assent of the majority of the people would be sufficient for its establishment. And as a majority have adopted it, already the remaining states would be bound by the act of the majority, even if they unanimously reprobated it. Anyway, so what does he mean by reprobated? I'll have to look that up because, you know, it's one of those words that we need to define and disclose. So I will bring retrobated back up in our next session. I'm not going to take the time to do the research on it, but I will check it out and we will have that in our next session, our next episode. Were it such a government as, and he goes on and says this, and I'm trying to close this out, I got 2 minutes. Were it as such a government as suggested, it would now be binding on the people of this state without having had the privilege of deliberating upon it. But, sir, no state is bound by it, as it is without its own consent. All the states adopt it. It will then be a government established by the 13 states of America, not through the intervention of the legislatures, but by the people at large, by people selecting who their delegates are. Because remember, the people did not vote as a democratic process to accept. They elected delegates to go debate and then select. In this particular respect, the distinction between the existing and proposed governments is very material. The existing system has been derived from the dependent derivative authority of the legislatures of the states, whereas this is derived from the superior power of the people. Got to remember, the states are representatives of the people, the state legislatures. And as a matter of fact, they were all dissimilar, as Madison pointed out. So it became a commonality amongst all the states when they started creating bicameral legislative bodies and a House of Representatives for the people and a House of Representatives for the, which is the Senate for the state governments or the sub-elements of government, which we call the counties or parishes. If we look at the manner in which alterations are to be made in it, the same idea is in some degree attended to. And so I'm going to kind of stop right there. When we come back in our next episode, we will carry this on. I will have reprobated the definition of that and put it into context for you. So that way we can actually look at what kind of Madison was stating just a couple of sentences ago. But bottom line, as we look at everything that these men are saying, they're actually defining this Constitution and how it is going to take form, how it will make context to our government of today even. And so these are the terms and definitions of this compact. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am
trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.